Hey, get hip. It's Bebop. So in this podcast, we're going to try and do three things. First, we're going to talk a little bit about general context and get you thinking a bit about what some of the issues might be before our discussion in class. Second, we're going to listen to the music and see if we can figure out what some of the changes are between this and the previous musics we've listened to. And three, I want to introduce you to some of the big names that you really have to know. There are four of them: Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell, and Thelonious Monk. You probably think that historians are concerned with facts. And you'd be right. We do want to get the facts right. But history is much more than facts. It's how do they go together? How do they add up? So in this case, we know that we get this music, this new music that arises in the 1940s. But the question, the important question is why? What are the factors that come together to make this new music happen now? So as you do your reading before class and as you listen to some of the musical changes we're going to talk about later in this podcast, think about why. Why might have young African-American musicians wanted to change the music that had until very recently been the chief agent of African-American business success in America? Remember that for someone like Duke Ellington or for Louis Armstrong, jazz had been a way into a new middle class. It had meant success. Black artists were famous. They were making a living doing something that was generally credited as new. Swing was a great thing. Even if white band leaders had come along and made it more famous, it was still an African-American music that was popular, and you could still make a living doing it. So why in the 1940s would the music suddenly change? And of course, that in and of itself is one of those contested facts. We can hear that the music is clearly different and sounds different, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But the historical question is this a fundamental revolution? Has something fundamentally changed about the attitude and the way we produce music? Or is this still jazz? Is bebop even jazz? Becomes a question that historians have to answer. But let's start with the question of what's different. By now, you should recognize this as the sound of the 20s and Louis Armstrong and Chicago jazz. The rhythmic two-step. One, two, one, two, one, two. The busy front line of cornet, clarinet, and trombone. All of this should be familiar to you now. While the music and the dancing would both be a little up and down, a little jerky, the point was that the tempo's not too fast. This is primarily dance music, as is the music of the 30s and the big bands. This is, of course, swing, the version of jazz that becomes America's popular music for a while in the 30s. The watchwords here are smooth and medium tempos for dancing. The bands have gotten bigger for reasons we talked about last week. So now you've got multiple trumpets, multiple trombones, multiple saxes. So again, this is popular music. Americans are buying it. You can make a living playing it. Of course, to be fair, Benny Goodman was actually pretty hip in playing swing. Most musicians, as is true today, were not playing the hippest music. Most musicians in the swing era were playing a slightly watered-down version, ballads, vocal music. The first number one hit on the hit parade in 1945 was Doris Day with Les Brown singing Sentimental Journey. So the most popular versions of jazz were this very sweet swing, sentimental ballads, and of course, with an all-white face. Now that might have been fine for dancing if you were a white teenager, but African-American teenagers wanted something with a little bit more pep in it. And so at the same time in the 40s, we see the rise of another new music called jump blues, or later rhythm and blues. As you can hear, it's a form of the blues played a little faster with more rhythm. So it's faster and more rhythmic, but you can hear that it's actually a version of Count Basie riff style, that it's a series of repeated riffs played with lots and lots of rhythm for dancing. So at the very moment that jazz becomes America's popular music, it begins to fragment into more sweet sentimental ballads and this new form of jump blues. And then at the same time, we get this, bebop. So what's different about this music? Well, for one thing, it's faster. In fact, it's too fast to dance to. But at the same time, it's also a lighter, looser feel. It doesn't have that kind of slamming rhythm that you expect in dance music where you get a hard backbeat. It's kind of light. Listen to the drums. In fact, you can barely hear the drums. As we'll do a demo in class, the time is shifted to the hi-hat. You get bombs being dropped in the bass drum. The time is more irregular. Notice that the time is now always in four. The bass is always playing on all four beats, but it's a much lighter four. One, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. It's a much more muscular, virtuoso music than swing. And you should also be able to hear how it's more angular, how the lines bop up and down, giving it its name, bebop. So now I want to play you an interesting demonstration of how the melody lines in bebop are faster and more angular. You've been listening to Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, but here is a Charlie Parker clip from something called Jazz at the Philharmonic in 1946. So the context this time is different. He's playing here with other guys that you know, including Lester Young. It's a tune called Lady Be Good, and you can hear that when Charlie Parker starts to play, he wants to play in the style of these older musicians. They're essentially playing in an old concert, an old jamming riff style. And in fact, there's going to be a little simple riff behind him at one point. So listen to how he starts. So this is essentially Charlie Parker trying to sound like Lester Young with Count Basie. Notice not only the riffs, but how he's playing right in the tempo with the rhythm section. Ba-do, ga-do, 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 ga-do. So while this is recognizable as Charlie Parker because of the sound of the horn, listening to this, you would have to say that this is a swing style jam. This sounds like swing musicians. Oops, not anymore. Now it sounds like Charlie Parker. It's kind of like the kid in the candy store. Charlie Parker's really, really trying to be good and to pay honor to the older musicians he's playing with. But in the end, he just kind of gives in, well, just a little, and sounds like himself. So let's see if we can figure out what that means. Here again is the passage where Charlie Parker begins to display the typical, angular, fast lines of bebop. So the music's actually going along in a kind of a slow four. One, two, three, four, one. Nice swing dancing tempo. One, two, three, four. But Charlie Parker's ignoring that. So he's playing. It's not just fast, it's as if it's too fast. It's not in sync with what the rhythm section's doing. So that for a swing player, if the rhythm section plays a one, two, three, four, then you play, if you're Lester Young, you're gonna play a one and two, a three, a four, a do, ba do, ba do. You're gonna reinforce the rhythm by playing more of the same rhythm. So here is Lester Young playing the same tune, Lady Be Good, with Count Basie. So start by tapping your foot. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. And notice how Lester Young is right in time with your foot. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Yeah, ba do, 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 ba do. Right. So Lester Young, the quintessential swing saxophonist, solos by playing right in time with the rhythm section. Now let's go back and hear Charlie Parker trying to sound like Lester Young on the same tune. Again, you should be able to tap your foot. One, two, three, four. And hear Charlie Parker. One, a two, a three, a four. A one, a two, a three, a four. Mostly. Trying to play in the groove. Now once more, we listen to the end of this solo, where Charlie Parker, playing with the same rhythm section, starts to take flight. You can still hear the rhythm section, boom, 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 boom. But you can hear Charlie Parker playing against the time in the rhythm section. It's angular, it's fast, it's bebop. So now let's meet the members of the band. You have to know Charlie Parker, also known as Yardbird or Bird. He was the most influential jazz player of the modern school. By 1950, every young player in the country was copying him. He was also a serious, studied artist. In a 1948 downbeat blindfold test, he correctly identifies Stravinsky's A Song of the Nightingale, goes on to talk about Prokofiev, Hindemith, and Debussy. He was born in 1929 in Kansas, and then moved to Kansas City, Missouri, where he'd listen a lot to the Basie band behind the Reno Club and to Lester Young. You may have noticed a similarity in sound. Lester Young also has a kind of light, airy sound in his tenor sax playing. Then Charlie Parker studied music with Tommy Douglas, who was a graduate of the Boston Conservatory. He became interested in higher harmonics and chords. He practiced all the time. He moved to New York in 1939 to seek out jam sessions. He went to Minton's, met Dizzy Gillespie, talked to the other musicians working out this new style. He played for a while in some big bands with Jay McShane. He played in the Metronome All-Stars. And in fact, that's how he got his name, Bird. He was on a bus with Jay McShane and the band, and they hit a chicken. The bus just hit a chicken. Another word for chicken is yard bird, a bird that you can keep in the yard. And it ran out into the road and the bus hit it. And so Charlie Parker insisted that they stop the bus so that he could go out and get this chicken. And so he did. They stopped the bus. He ran out behind the bus. He grabbed this essentially roadkill, grabbed the chicken. And when they got to Lincoln, Nebraska, he had the cook in the house fry it up for him. And so ever after that, they called him Yardbird, or just Bird for short. Then in 1945, Charlie Parker begins to make a series of recordings that will change history. You've been listening to Dizzy Gillespie in the All-Star Quintet with Dizzy Gillespie on trumpet and Charlie Parker on alto sax. That was Salt Peanuts. Here now, from November in the same year, is Charlie Parker recording for the first time with himself as the leader, and with a young guy called Miles Davis playing the trump. Oops, you can hear how Miles muffs the high note. This is Miles Davis trying to sound like Dizzy Gillespie, and not doing a very good job. I mean, the sound is totally unlike Dizzy Gillespie's, but that's okay. Miles is beginning to discover his own sound that we'll hear later. For our purposes, part of what's interesting is that Charlie Parker's trying to form his own quintet. He hires Miles Davis. He's in fact put together a great quintet with Curly Russell on bass, Max Roach on drums, and Bud Powell on piano. And then in the morning, he discovers that Bud Powell has gone to visit his mother in Philadelphia. So he doesn't have a piano player. But lucky for him, Dizzy Gillespie drops by, and so Dizzy Gillespie sits in on piano. Well then, Miles Davis falls asleep. So we hear Dizzy Gillespie playing the trumpet on this famous recording of Charlie Parker's Coco. So that's the intro, and then the tune starts. Yeah, and that's Herman Lubinsky, the owner of Savoy Records, who's running out to stop the recording because he recognizes the tune. That's Cherokee. What often happens in bebop is that musicians will take a tune that already exists and then play a new melody over it, sometimes called a contrafactum. So on this recording section, the standard contract was in play. Charlie Parker was supposed to bring four new compositions to record in a three-hour session. So when the band starts playing Cherokee, and Lubinsky can recognize, he says, well, that's not okay. I paid for new compositions. So then they re-record Coco, only this time they use only the introduction, and then instead of playing the melody, they leave the chord changes, the rhythm section plays the chord changes, and essentially their new improvised solos over these changes. So the intro is the same. It consists of 8 bars of Diz and Bird playing together, 8 bars of Diz doing whatever he wants, 8 bars of Charlie Parker improvising, and then 8 bars of them playing, again, this unison line. That's it. And then Charlie Parker takes the first solo. When you listen to Charlie Parker, it's almost as if he's playing too fast for the horn, too fast for the band. The music is fast enough already. Again, the rhythm section is light, but very fast. You may have to focus a bit more to hear the time. But it's very fast. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. And Charlie Parker seems to be playing across the time of the rhythm section. Notice that Max Roach is dropping bombs in the rhythm section, trying to mess up the time a bit, both on the snare drum and in the bass drum. Wow, that's one of Charlie Parker's greatest solos, one of bebop's greatest performances. That's a recording you should listen to over and over and know well. Almost immediately after these recordings, Bird and Diz went to Hollywood for a 6-week gig. But Bird had a nervous breakdown there from heroin and alcohol addiction and spent 7 months in Camarillo State Hospital recovering before he returned to New York in 1947. Here is Charlie Parker trying to make a recording on the day he was hospitalized. Thank you. It hardly sounds like Charlie Parker. He has a little trouble getting started. He misses his entrance. We still hear flashes of the genius, but drugs and alcohol had taken their toll. Drugs, alcohol, and ulcers would continue to dog his life and his playing. Then in 1950, he fulfilled a lifelong dream to record with strings. Some of his fans screamed he'd gone commercial, but some think it's his best work. So is Charlie Parker a hot or a cool musician? It's interesting because in some ways, Bird is both the quintessential bop musician, hot, angular, fast, but he's also the impetus for cool jazz. His gentle lyricism, light sound, veiled indirection, and subtle nuance all help lead to the cool school of jazz. But at the same time, he had dazzling technique and was in some ways the hottest of players in the 40s. What Charlie Parker plays, bebop, or some derivative of that style, becomes the basic style of modern jazz that most current jazz musicians play today. The approach that we take today in teaching and in playing is still basically the approach to solos and the harmonic language that are his approach. And finally, one last example. This is Charlie Parker playing the ballad Embraceable You by George Gershwin. The first thing I want you to notice is this six-note phrase, ba-dee-ba-doo-ba-doo. It's a motive that he starts, and then he plays with it. He turns it around five times, plays it in different places. It's no different than what Beethoven does with ba-ba-ba-bum, where he takes an idea and moves it around. Listen again. So there's the idea, ba-dee-ba-da-ba-da. He plays it again. A little higher, da-dee-ba-da-da-da. Plays it again, higher. There it is again. There it again, with a little tag. Dee ba da ba da. So he takes this idea, ba dee ba da ba da, ba dee ba da ba da, and he makes his whole solo around it. Listen one more time. So improvisation is just composition in real time. It's the same thing as composing, only you do it while standing there. And Beethoven used a piece of paper and wrote it down. So maybe you're thinking, well, okay, maybe Charlie Parker wrote it down first and he planned it all out. Well, no, because about 30 seconds later they said, hey, Bird, can you do it again? He said, sure. And another pearl flows through the horn, but a totally different one this time, bears no resemblance to the previous solo. Equally interesting, equally unified, but improvised, spontaneous composition. So the other half of this dynamic duo was a trumpet player named Dizzy Gillespie, born in South Carolina. They had played together in the first real bebop band, but Dizzy Gillespie had wanted to play in big bands, perhaps because he was a product of the 30s. You know, so his mother kept saying, you know, when are you going to be a real musician and have your own band, which in the 30s had meant a big band. So Dizzy always had a fondness for big bands. He played with Cab Calloway. But even when he was in Cab Calloway's band, Diz was always playing wrong notes or playing really new advanced harmonics. What Cab Calloway said, called Chinese music. He said, I don't want you playing any of that Chinese music in my band. Because Dizzy would play a flatted fifth, and he would just hold one of these notes. And everybody else thought it was wrong. And it eventually became part of the harmonic language of jazz. Now, Dizzy's name is kind of funny because he had this onstage personality that was a little wacky and crazy. But behind the scenes, Diz was one of the best businessmen, solid family men in the business. And, you know, he several times fired Charlie Parker because, you know, he didn't show up on time or he was on drugs. Dizzy was very clean, ran a very tight ship, but earned his nickname Dizzy because of his onstage antics. And of course, his playing was a little out of control too. It was fast, high, loud, angular, lots of notes. Only it's totally hot. It's more muscular. There's nothing subtle or cool about it. It really is in your face, up and down all the time. As with Charlie Parker, it's technically brilliant. It's literally higher and faster than we've ever heard any trumpet player play before. It's a totally new way to play the trumpet. It's a new sound. If you have visuals, look at the picture that goes along with this section. See if you can find Dizzy Gillespie in amongst that crowd of beboppers. Those became bebop glasses that you could buy with the little beret and the goatee, all to imitate Dizzy Gillespie. It's an interesting kind of counterculture in the 50s because this music was not mainstream. It was not popular. You could not dance to it. But visually, Dizzy became the leader and the icon of this new music, bebop. Now you might think that it's impossible to play the trombone in the same way that Dizzy Gillespie played the trumpet. Well, you're partially right. I mean, the trumpet is a more agile instrument. But J.J. Johnson did manage to create a style of bebop trombone, and here's what it sounds like. So he's playing the trombone. It doesn't quite have the speed or the agility of the trumpet, but that's J.J. Johnson bebop trombone. There are two bebop pianists that you need to know, but we'll start with the easier and more typical, Bud Powell. You've already heard Bud Powell, because Bud Powell was the piano player on some of those records with Charlie Parker. So this rhythm section with Curly Russell on bass, Max Roach on drums, was the rhythm section for Charlie Parker. On its own, we call this a piano trio, piano, bass, drums, and it becomes a standard group from here on out. So here is Bud Powell and his piano trio. I hope by now this is pretty easily recognizable as bebop. The light, fast four rhythm and the darting, angular melodic lines. Notice that Bud Powell's essentially playing the piano the way Charlie Parker plays the sax or Dizzy Gillespie plays the trumpet, which means he's really only using one hand. You can hear him playing counter lines in the left hand, but for the most part, what you hear is single notes in the right hand played very quickly. This doesn't sound at all like Count Basie or Earl Hines. Remember, Earl Hines played that trumpet style with the right hand in octaves, and Count Basie played lots of little chords and had lots of space in his music. There'll be a whole piano demonstration in class, but hopefully you can learn to recognize the sound of Bud Powell playing bebop piano. You may remember that I said that Bud Powell was from Philadelphia. Well, he'd always been a bit of a frantic performer, but his career deteriorated after he was beaten by police and arrested in Philadelphia. He was taken to Creedmoor State Hospital on Long Island, where he was, quote-unquote, treated. He was treated with electric shock therapy multiple times, something that was reserved only for black patients, because he was diagnosed with illusions of grandeur, because when the doctor asked him who he was, he said his name was Bud Powell. And the doctor said, "You mean Bud Powell, like the famous pianist Bud Powell?" And he said, "Yes, that's me." The doctor concluded that this was impossible for someone with these symptoms, and that he must be having delusions of grandeur. And so he submitted him to this electric shock therapy. And it was only another doctor who recognized who he really was, who finally snuck him out of the hospital so that he survived, but he was never quite the same again. So while Bud Powell is easily recognizable as a bebop pianist, Thelonious Monk is much harder to characterize. So where Bud Powell was muscular and fast, Thelonious Monk is spare and quirky. He's also a marvelous composer, but his tunes are hard to play and really take them apart because they're so carefully crafted they always sound like Thelonious Monk. This piece is called Well You Needn't. It has a little quirky melody that repeats. So it's kind of a riff style piece, except that the cell's a little strange. Listen to some of Monk's solo. So in some ways, we could recognize this as bebop. I mean, it's a relatively fast tempo. The rhythm section has that light 4-4 groove. But the solo has a lot of space. He does not play a lot of notes. He has a kind of odd sense of timing, too. So he plays out of time, a bit like Charlie Parker does. So this is Thelonious Monk playing in a piano trio. That's also similar. But ultimately, Monk's piano style is a much broader, quirkier mix of styles. He likes to mix styles, so that you'll hear a little bit of stride piano from Fats Waller. He'll play horn lines like Earl Hines. But then he'll also add distinctive timbres that are only Monk. Tone clusters, or playing very high with playing lots of notes together, or playing stark intervals like the seventh, just two notes that clash. There's a kind of rough, dark quality. It's unorthodox. His technique is a little strange, but it's the sound he wanted and an odd sense of rhythm all combined to make Monk recognizable immediately. Here again is Monk playing in a piano trio, one of his compositions, Ruby My Dear. And here's one final example, Thelonious Monk soloing on his own composition, Crisscross. It's sort of ironic that Monk's work is in the end neither difficult, eccentric, nor obscure, but logical and structured. No, he's not an entertainer, but he does show us everything he does in a kind of direct, unadorned music. So ultimately, if bebop is supposed to be about fast tempos and cascading, jerky melody and rapid runs, well, Monk's music doesn't really fit into this category, although you could say there's certainly jerky melody and there are cascading runs. But Monk has a slightly different project. But this opens the door on a kind of bigger issue. When we talk about a history of art, we often talk about the typical exemplar of a style. But for all art, especially jazz, we're not really interested in typical. We're interested in the extraordinary. That's why we come to art. So sometimes there's a conflict between wanting to teach you the easy, typical part of the style and the unique, exotic, eccentric character of a unique musician. Thelonious Monk is just one of those musicians. He does his own thing, but in some ways, that's what jazz musicians do.